Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Ion Travel with Peter Greenberg ad-free and right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
Have you ever covered a carpet stain with a rug? Ignored a leaky faucet? Pretended your half-painted living room is supposed to look like that? Well, you're not alone. We've all got unfinished home projects. But there's an easier way. When you download Thumbtack, it's easier to care for your home from top to bottom. Pull out your phone and in just a few steps, you can search, chat, and book highly rated pros right in your neighborhood. Plus, you'll know what to tackle next because Thumbtack is the app that shows you what to do, who to hire, and when. So say goodbye to all those unfinished home projects and say hello to caring for your home the easier way. Download Thumbtack and start a project today.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
This is the Ion Travel Podcast with CBS News travel editor Peter Greenberg, presented by Clear. Enroll today at clearme.com/IonTravel and try Clear at the busiest airports nationwide.
Hi, everybody. Peter Greenberg here, and welcome to another edition of the Ion Travel Podcast. It's a story that's changing direction and intensity every day. The ongoing struggles of the cruise ship industry to sail again in U.S. waters. And it pits the cruise lines against the Centers for Disease Control. While the CDC did lift its no-sail order last November, it replaced it with a conditional sail order requiring the cruise lines to comply with more than 70 design, technical, and procedural changes. The cruise lines claim they've done all that, but the CDC has not lifted that conditional sail order. In the process, the cruise lines are now playing hardball, in many cases moving their ships out of U.S. ports entirely and the jurisdiction of the CDC, and starting to sail within the next 2 months. I'll talk with Kelly Craighead, CEO of CLIA, that's the Cruise Lines International Association, representing a majority of the cruise lines around the world, about the situation and, of course, about what it means to you.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Kelly, this is a great opportunity for us to do a serious catch-up, to go back and look about where everything was a year ago, and of course, bring us all the way through to today. So let's start with a year ago. It was not a happy time in the travel industry. It was not a happy time in the world. The optics in terms of the cruise industry were pretty intense. Almost indelible images of cruise ships quarantined in Tokyo, or actually in Yokohama, of cruise ships being unable to disgorge their passengers in other ports, other problems in Australia with other ships. Those were indelible images. And of course, shortly thereafter, the cruise ship business came to a stop, not just in the United States, but globally. And hundreds of ships were idled. And that's how much of the industry still remains today. But let's go back there. What did you immediately do? And what did you immediately reach out to, especially since the Centers for Disease Control issued a no sail order? And then you had to deal with not just the Centers for Disease Control in the United States, but so many different governments around the world.
Right. Well, thank you so much for the question, Peter. I think you said it exactly right. A year ago, I think the whole world was in its first crisis of a century, grappling with some unimaginable circumstances. So from the cruise industry perspective, we were an early symbol of what was to come to a much wider universe beyond travel and tourism and really impact the entire world. For us, we have maintained putting people first. And that is what we did from the earliest moment, working with the health authorities, following their direction, returning passengers, returning crew, returning ships at a time when the whole world was trying to understand what was happening was particularly challenging. But one of the things the cruise industry is so good at, again, is putting people first and really looking for those opportunities, even as countries and borders were shutting down, to work tirelessly to repatriate passengers and crew. And luckily, we had that opportunity to work constructively with governments to be able to return all of the passengers home and over time crew, except for those that remain on the ships that have to be maintained. You know, we were really one of the first industries to voluntarily suspend. You know, this from the earliest days of the pandemic, you could see the cruise industry was putting into practice all of the things that we've learned over the many decades about the ability to control the circumstances as best as possible on a ship. So feeling that it was the right thing to do, we voluntarily suspended. And subsequently, the CDC issued a no sail order for all ships, which we were under then for the next 7 months until they issued a conditional sail order in October.
And let's talk about that conditional sail order, because what it required the cruise lines to do was to be in compliance with a number, many dozen different changes, protocols, floor design changes, ventilation, boarding procedures, disembarking procedures, all of those things before they would actually then give you the green light to sail from any U.S. port.
Well, I have to tell you, it's a little bit different. So the conditional sail order is supposedly a plan for phased resumption of cruising, which is what we want. And in fact, it's what has happened in other places around the world outside of the United States, which is a highly controlled return to service using protocols that the industry has developed that, like you said, considers the entire experience from when you leave home to while you're on the ship, to the excursion that you have, to when you return home. We've done that productively working with governments to ultimately find ourselves in a place where more than 400,000 passengers have sailed successfully using these protocols with fewer than 50 instances of any cases reported, which is so much lower than anything that you can find in land or any other venue. So you fast forward or reverse to the United States, where the conditional sail order, again, is supposed to be a phased return of service. It went into place on October 30th. So far, we've only received the instruction on the first phase, which has to do with the care of crew. And so we see the CSO a little bit is outdated, because when that issue that order was issued in October, it certainly didn't take into consideration how much has changed since last fall, including the introduction of vaccines. And it certainly didn't reflect the experience that the cruise industry is having in other parts of the world. And so, again, I think it's these proven protocols that do, as you say, Peter, take into account testing, take into account 100% testing of passengers and crew. In fact, the cruise industry was the first industry to require 100% of passengers and crew be tested. And in addition to that is this multi-layered approach that not only impacts your departure, but your time on the ship. So enhanced medical services, increased ventilation, all of the rest of the things that you see on land, including physical distancing, but also agreements with the places that we visit and the ability to have enhanced medical care on board ships. And so whereas it's been devastating to be suspended and in fact to be the only industry that's currently prohibited from operating in the United States, it has given the industry an opportunity over those first early months to take the benefit of outside experts advising us on these protocols that, again, have proven effective even before there was a vaccine. So we are looking forward to considering how vaccines, once they're widely available, can be incorporated into our protocols to make them even more robust than they already are. So we do feel that it's been a long journey, and we really look forward to working with the Biden administration to reopening cruising in the United States so it can join some of the others around the world that, again, is finding cruising the best way to see the world.
Well, let's go back. Before we get to the Biden administration, let's go back to those 400,000 passengers who did cruise successfully. What were the protocols and the regimes that you followed in conjunction with those foreign governments and those regulatory authorities to allow that to happen?
Right. And in fact, CLIA has a COVID policy that details this in some length, but the protocols cover the entire cruise experience. So again, significant amount of testing before you leave home at the pier, and for crew to have quarantined before they arrive on the ship, for the ship to be in the best possible shape with enhanced hygiene, with increased ventilation, with increased medical capabilities. So one of the things I think few people know about cruise ships, particularly the bigger ones, is they have state-of-the-art medical capabilities. They have even more of that now. And that's what you saw this summer and through this year is enhanced medical capabilities paired with what you would see on land in terms of mask wearing, hand washing, physical distancing, increased ventilation. But then it's important to understand also that the experience of cruising is in engaging around your itinerary and the shore excursion. So working in partnership with the ports, with the destinations to have matching protocols and to enforce those protocols. It's one thing to have them. It's another thing to enforce them. And it's the enforcement and it's the responsibility of the passengers and the responsibility of the operators, both on the ship and on the land, to create this experience where you mitigate the risk of COVID as much as possible. And that's where we've seen real success. And again, the incidence rate that has been reported on the sailings that have taken place since last summer are significantly lower than anything that we've seen on land or in any other venue. So we're pleased with the protocols, and they'll continue to evolve and adapt as the situation evolves and adapts. And so we look forward to having more and more sailing because, again, it is a phased return to service. It's not a light switch. We're not going to go from off to on. It's more like a dimmer. And in that respect, we do see it getting lighter every day.
Well, towards that end, the reality in the U.S. right now is there are no U.S. cruise ships of any size that are sailing from any U.S. ports or to any U.S. ports. Canada has closed their ports effectively through February of 2022. So there's no Alaska summer cruise season. There's no New England fall foliage season, just like there was not one last year as well. So that part of
no
it, we
spring
know.
Break.
Yep. So that part of it, we know. There are calls, of course, coming from the cruise lines, as well as the governor of Florida, to ask the CDC to accelerate their decision-making to allow you to go back in that phased-in program with U.S. ports. But the reality is we're now in April, and people don't decide to go on a cruise ship the day before. Cruise ships don't just miraculously show up at a port the day before. So we're really dealing 4 or 5 months down the road at the very earliest, even if they were to open the ports. So let's talk about what some of the cruise lines have done to still perform to the protocols that you want, but not necessarily in U.S. ports. You have cruise lines like Crystal, you have cruise lines like Royal Caribbean and Celebrity that are physically repositioning their ships right now and taking them to make them home-ported ships, meaning they are going to start there and end there in countries like Bermuda, the Bahamas, St. Lucia, and as far away as Israel. People will no longer be able to drive to their port cities from the United States, but they can certainly fly there. And those cruise ships are selling out their cabins now.
That's right. You have it exactly right. I think obviously our first choice, our sincere hope is that we'll be able to resume operations from the United States. North America is the largest cruise market in the world. Americans love cruising as much as almost anybody else in the world. And the ability for Americans who, after such a long and enduring year, are eager to get out and to be in the outdoors and have the fresh air and to take a cruise, to really be able to have their experience facilitated in a way that is both safe and so enjoyable is driving this demand to get on a ship. And if we can't operate from the United States, clearly there are other places who welcome the opportunity to be a home port where people make that a destination. They spend extra days there. They spend extra money there. And what's heartbreaking to see is that most of these itineraries are going to involve Americans having to go through Miami anyway to get there. So that's why we really want to work with the Biden administration and with the CDC, because again, the world has changed greatly since the original order was issued. Clearly, the state of the public health in the United States is vastly different. We look at the environment around us, we understand that all adults that are will be eligible to receive the vaccine in the United States by early May, some indications by the end of this month. We understand that there is a desire to be closer to normal in July. We find it hard to believe that the U.S. could be closer to normal if our longshoremen are not working, if our port operators are not working, if the people who grow and sell flowers are not able to deliver them to cruise ships. You know, this is really a matter of working with the administration to have them understand that we are an industry that is currently prohibited from operating, that we do have a proven track record, that the conditions have changed, and we should be like other travel and tourism as we try to get in that same alignment with trying to reopen by early summer. But as you said, Peter, you know, unlike some of these other venues and experiences that you can have, cruise ships take time, and the protocols that we have in place are complex. And so having ships in the arena, having crew, having the ability to execute against kind of all of the protocols takes about 75, 90 days, which is why we've called for the CSO to be lifted, because we'd like to be in a position, we'd like to have the certainty in May that we'll be able to operate in July, because it's with that certainty that all these jobs can come back. And it's with the confidence that we have mitigated the risk of COVID as much, if not more, than any other industry sector. So we really do see this as a great opportunity to demonstrate that you can do both. That you can provide for public health and you can be a bridge to economic recovery. So we look forward to being part of that good news story.
Well, you brought up the two big issues here, public health issue and economic impact. From a public health issue, it's essentially non-negotiable. You're either ready or you're not ready. And so the question is, based on all the months that you guys have been working now to basically redesign protocol, behaviors, physical design, are you ready?
We are ready. We are ready. We are set, and we want to sail.
Now, having said that, we're now getting into politics, economic impact, the governor of Florida calling for it as well. Of course, that raises issues of jurisdiction and ability to make those kind of rules. Where do we stand now? Because the last I heard, as part of the conditional sail order, you had to do a mock cruise with crew. You had to do a mock cruise with volunteer passengers. I remember, speaking of pent-up demand, that when Royal Caribbean put out a notice that they were planning on doing these mock cruises to be able to basically comply with the CDC rules, and they're asking for volunteer passengers, hundreds of thousands of people said, take me, I'm ready, let's go.
Right.
But those cruises have not happened yet.
Right, that's right. Well, part of it, as I said earlier, the issue is ordered at the end of October. It was designed to be a phased resumption that included four phases. Some of those phases included test sailings. It's been 5 months since that was issued. We have had significant sailings in other parts, testing and proving that the protocols work. So part of getting back onto the water in the U.S. is really looking at what's old news and what's new news. So we do have a plan that has proven effective around how we have enhanced protocols. Like with every other government that we're working with in the world, we'd love to have the opportunity to introduce ourselves to the Biden administration, to be given the opportunity to be treated like other travel and tourism segments and work with them on the issues that they may have, knowing that these test sailings, in fact, have already happened. They've had test sailings, they've had passenger sailings, all of them that have operated under the CLIA member policy have so far operated very successfully, which is the important part that we're trying to address, which is this is mitigating risk. This is putting as much effort as we can in the middle of a health emergency that is going to give you the confidence that from the time you leave home to the time you're on the ship, that you are going to have the least risk that can exist while we're in the middle of a situation like this.
We know that Canadians closed their ports last year, and when it came to a decision time this year, they extended it for another year. And because of an old piece of legislation dating back to the 1800s, no ship not registered in the U.S. can go between two U.S. ports without stopping in a foreign port first. I failed geography in high school, but looking at the map, you can't get to Alaska from mainland United States without stopping in Canada. And therefore, if you can't stop in Canada, you can't get to Alaska. So that really wiped out your cruise season to Alaska for 2 years in a row.
Well, it's true that between the pace with which we're working with the CDC and the decision by the Canadians contributed to the fact that Alaska is going to lose another cruise season. And for communities like those communities in Alaska that are dependent on the cruise industry to be able to deliver passengers, you know, they're losing nearly $1 billion. 800 million of that is in cruise passenger receipts. And so you can see the crippling impact by potentially losing another season. And this, you know, Peter, you know, this is the impact on real people. This is about people losing their tax base so that they don't have schools and hospitals. This is real life stuff. It makes a huge difference. And I think certainly the Alaskans have been terrific supporters of the industry and are trying to work with the administration to understand and help put us on a path to be like the other travel and tourism industries. Because we are now at the place trying to come out of this pandemic as well as we can that is hyper-dependent on cruise tourism being part of the travel and tourism ecosystem.
Of course, I have to go back to the optics. And the optics for so many people are that cruise ships are like floating Petri dishes, or that I have friends of mine who have never taken a cruise, but the first words out of their mouth, if I talk to them about cruising, is you couldn't pay me to go on one of those. That's their impression, right? And yet two things are happening at the same time. Number one, an average of 2.5 million Americans are being vaccinated every day. And by the way, that number's only getting higher. Last week, I think it hit 3.5 million on one day. If you look at it by month, that's over 30 million a month. And that's compounded. It's getting more and more. That's number one. Number two, we're talking about a vaccination passport thing. That's one of the things that's being discussed, that it will be your ticket of admission, whether you want to go to a movie theater or a theme park or the grocery store or a cruise ship. We're seeing a number of your member cruise lines when they're home porting these ships in different countries saying the requirement's going to be our crew's going to be vaccinated, our officers are going to be vaccinated, and if you want to be a passenger on the ship, you have to show proof of vaccination. So I tell everybody this is the irony, because here we are coming from the original optics about what cruising was perceived to be. Here we're going to have a ship or ships with 100% vaccination compliance, which will probably be the safest places to be in the world.
Right. Well, you know, clearly, as you said, as more and more people become vaccinated, it really becomes a game changer for the whole wide world. And that will be the case for cruise ships as well. One of the challenges, of course, is the availability of vaccines. And so as we see more countries have more access and more successful rollout of the vaccines, like we've seen in the United States, you can see how the whole world gets lifted up by vaccines. And in the meantime, you know, for the cruise industry, it is not the single silver bullet that solves it all, because of course we have to have this multi-layered approach. There's a lot of reasons why the vaccines won't be 100% effective, whether it's because 5% of those vaccinated for whom it does not work, for children that may not be vaccinated. And so for us, it's really to work with the governments to meet them where they're at, where their comfort level is. And of course, when the vaccines are widely available, you've already seen the cruise industry take a leadership role in developing enhanced health and safety protocols that you can imagine will involve vaccinations. And for those smaller ships that are able to do that now, it is certainly good for us to be able to point to all the possibilities. So we do think that it's important to recognize in the United States that there are lots of ways to cruise, and cruisers love to cruise. And we've seen by the demand, the overwhelming demand, that people are ready to cruise, whether they're required to be vaccinated or not. And the good news is that whether you're vaccinated or not, we do have protocols in place right now that can mitigate the risk more than anything that we're seeing on land. So again, I go back to the place where it's not a light switch, it's a dimmer, and that dimmer is growing. And it's getting lighter every day because the world is changing so quickly. And the ability to really disprove some of these misperceptions, because we were an unfortunate symbol of the early days of the pandemic when the whole wide world was learning about something brand new. We've really been able to benefit from this last year in understanding how we can do this better. And the cruise industry has always been a leader in our ability to put people first. And this is just another example of how we'll get back on track, and we'll go back to that trajectory where we have to attract those people who are dubious about cruising because they have the misperceptions of it. And that's what I'm looking forward to getting back to do. Because as you know, Peter, cruising takes all shapes and forms. And there are all kinds of products out there to meet the different needs of different people. So whether you want a small luxury experience, whether you want a big kind of multi-generational experience so that your grandparents and the parents and the kids can have an experience, there really is something out there for everyone. And what is consistent across all of these different products is the adherence to putting people first and the incredibly robust protocols that exist to protect for health and safety, particularly for our members who have to sign to agree to implement these policies that, again, are going to adapt and evolve as it relates to COVID, but you can always trust that they will be leading the pack compared to anybody else.
You know, then there's, of course, the consumer element itself. You mentioned the increase in demand. I reported on this 2 weeks ago, and then I reported on a similar situation just this week where one cruise line put on its World Cruise for 2022, and it sold out in like a day, where the minimum cabin price was something like $40,000. Yeah. And then just a couple of days ago, Silversea put on their cruise for 2023, one of their grand tours, where the minimum cabin price was $74,000, and it sold out. So if there was ever any question about consumer demand or price point, that just went out the window.
Right. Demand is not going to be the issue. The issue is working with the many destinations around the world to work with the health authorities to give the assurances that they need to feel like they're providing for their citizens. We are trying to provide for our passengers and crew and their citizens. And so we've seen really good luck in the kind of partnership that we've seen in other parts of the world, because it really does take everybody to make sure that, again, first and foremost, it's about the public health. And that's why we feel so confident that we're moving in the right direction.
So, for example, in Greece, which is a huge destination for cruise ships, you've already worked with their government to be able to get ready to get ready. You've done that in Croatia. You've done that in Italy. And even though Italy right now may be in lockdown, they're ready for you now when you're ready to go.
That's right. I mean, it really, you know, you know this, Peter, because you're such an expert in all forms travel and tourism. You know, for places where cruising is an important part of their tourism economy, and remember that there are many places, whether it's Alaska, whether it's the Caribbean, in fact, even if it's in Greece, that airlines alone can't get you there. So what is so unique about cruising is that you can go to places that you otherwise couldn't get to. And so in places like Greece and like the Caribbean and like Alaska, they have developed good and strong working relationships with the cruise industry so that we can work together in partnership to address both their needs and our needs in a way that, again, results in a positive experience for everybody. You know, it was working with EU Healthy Gateways and EMSA last summer where they were able to put out an initial framework that really enabled us to then match our protocols and to work together to be in a place where now we can see the UK, who you didn't mention, who has put cruise in the same wave as other travel and tourism industries so that when domestic tourism resumes, cruising with domestic passengers will be part of that. And as they work towards opening international tourism, we're working towards cruise being part of that. And when we come back to the United States, we're looking for the same thing. We know that there many of our colleagues in travel and tourism are looking to open international inbound. We are looking to be part of that. If you think about how, you know, the desperate needs of communities, one of the interesting things, and I'd love one day for us to talk about this, Peter, is I think neighborhoods and communities and cities who never considered themselves really part of the travel and tourism economy have discovered, in fact, that travel and tourism is important to their neighborhood, to their community, and just the number of jobs that are affected by travel and tourism and how that extends to the cruise industry. So for me, I'm really looking forward to being able to use some of these examples of success of the partnership between the public and the private sector to arrive at outcomes that make health officials feel comfortable that they're providing for their citizenry, because that really is the opportunity. It's the invitation that we make in the United States is to, again, work in partnership to both point to what we've proven we can do successfully since the pandemic broke out, but also to realize the changed environment in which we're living. I mean, you said it. I think, you know, we've heard Dr. Fauci and others talk about the fact that the rate of vaccination is so great in the United States that there's some confidence that you can stay ahead of the variants. You know, there's not a single person in the cruise industry that wants to start before people are ready to start. And I think that with our protocols and what we know about the current landscape, we're ready to sail. So we look forward to having that opportunity and we need to get the word. We'd like to have it in May because we'd like to be operating this summer like everybody else. But most importantly, it's the certainty. You know, no one can come back to work until we know for sure we'll be able to operate. And what we're really working for is the people who were most deeply impacted by this suspension. And their stories are the stories that we're trying to tell because it really is about the people, not about ships, but the people who really benefit, not just as the cruisers, but the people who support cruising. So we're hopeful, Peter.
Kelly Craighead, the head of CLIA. Kelly, thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for having me. It's terrific. I appreciate it.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
My thanks to Kelly. Next up, thinking of traveling to Hawaii? It's my extended conversation with a legendary writer, author of The Old Patagonian Express, The Mosquito Coast, My Secret Life, and his most recent book, Under the Wave at Waimea. It's a deep and intimate look at the Hawaii surf culture, and in the process, Hawaii itself. And if anybody knows the difference between a tourist and a traveler, it's Paul Thoreau. I want to start by talking about a definition of a term which I take issue with, and that term is travel writer. To me, it still has sort of a negative connotation because there are very few writers who are really good at travel. and the other people are travel writers. My next guest is really good at writing, and he's really good at travel. In fact, he's legendary. He's written everything from the Mosquito Coast to the Railway Bazaar, the Dark Star Safari, On the Plane of Snakes. His new book, basically from where he actually lives right now, Under the Wave at Waimea. His name, if you haven't figured it out by now, is Paul Theroux. Paul, welcome to the show.
Peter, lovely to talk to you again, and aloha from the...
You had to get the aloha in, I know you did. We're going to get back to aloha in a second, because I want to go back to what I said in the introduction, Paul, about the definition of terms of the word travel writer, because to me, you happen to be an amazing writer who also travels, and I think there's a difference. And then when you get to a destination, it's really about storytelling, and it's not just a destination. I've always said the destination should be incidental to the experience. In your situation, you're already telling us about a sense of place. You're already telling us about a history of something way before we ever realized how different it really might be. And in this new book, which, by the way, I have to, in the interest of full disclosure, I have to tell everybody, you just celebrated your 80th birthday. Can I say that? Oh, wait a minute. I just did. You really are talking about, for lack of a better term, it's a novel about a sort of an aging 60-plus surfer, a legend surfer, and you give him a name, Joe Sharkey, which I love that name, by the way, because Joe Sharkey, I know a Joe Sharkey. He wrote the travel column in the New York Times for years. But for me, and many of my listeners may not know this, I come from a surfing family. And my relatives are Hawaiian. So I had particular interest in reading this book because my uncle was a surfing champion. He was a legendary surfing champion. He's in the Surfing Hall of Fame, but he made his mark surfing the beaches in Hawaii. And on those days, the boards were not the boards of today. They were wooden. They were mahogany. They weighed 140 pounds. They were long boards that were about 14 feet long. I have no idea how I ever carried them when I was a kid. And they had no skeg, right? You went where the waves took you. You couldn't cut. And this is someone in your book who probably grew up with those kind of boards and is still surfing today.
Yeah, well, so I didn't realize that you had surfers in your ancestry. That's really interesting. Well, the book is about an older surfer. He's a legend, as you say. He's the shark. I'd always wanted to write about surfing because I live on the north shore of Oahu, and I live among surfers. I talk to surfers. I paddle a canoe, an outrigger canoe, and sometimes I can surf a very small wave with my canoe. But I live in a kind of water world, and that's the world that I wanted to write about. I've been working on the book a lot. Actually, I started about 8 years ago, and it was interrupted mainly by there was a certain xenophobic head of state here who began to disparage Mexicans. So in the middle of writing the book, I decided to write a book about Mexico, and then I finished Under the Wave at Waimea, which is the title of the book. Did you want to talk about...
Well, what I really want to talk about is how you get into a story like this, because when you talk about surfing, you're really talking about a culture, and you're even talking about a language. You know, you talk about Under the Wave at Waimea. Well, in Hawaii, there's legend and there's myth, and everything has a name. You know, when people in Hawaii say they want to talk story, they're not kidding. And, right, every wave has a name.
That's right. Every break has a name. That's absolutely true. And a surfer knows the island not by towns. They wouldn't say, well, he lives in Haleiwa or he lives in Waialua or Mokulaia, which are towns or small communities. He would say he lives at Rocky Point. He lives at Velzyland. He lives at Chun's Reef. He lives at Lani's. He lives at Poena Point, which are specific waves. He lives at Pipeline, they would say. Or he lives just near Pipeline. He lives near Sunset. And I think this is probably true in California, where you are now. I mean, I think that people would refer to the surf break to the surf break as a destination or as a place. And the water is a place. If you live in an archipelago like Hawaii, with a bunch of islands, the land, I mean, for example, the Kaiwi Channel runs between Molokai and Oahu. that's where a lot of canoeists, people with canoes like myself, that's where they paddle, and there's a certain race. So the sea has a name. Places on the sea have a name. It's not just water out there. It's a specific type of water. And that's the other thing, is it's a type of wave. So the wave at Pipeline is different from the wave at Buena Point.
Oh, you're not kidding. You're not kidding. In fact, I made a mistake once. I will tell you this. I learned how to surf in Sandy Beach. And I survived that. And that gave me a false sense of confidence. And all my relatives are Hawaiian. They took me to the North Shore, where you live. And they took me over to Sunset. And I rode one wave and one wave only. And, you know, I grew up in New York. And if you surf in New York, which I did out on Fire Island, if you fall off the board, yeah, you get creamed. And then you stay down for about 20 seconds and you pop up. If you are in Hawaii at Sunset and you fall off the board or get creamed, the waves are basically saying to you, you're not coming up. And then it throws you onto the beach like some beached mammal, and with sand in every crevice of your body. And you say to yourself at that point, the gods have sent me a message, and the message is, don't go back. You can watch, but you can't go back. And that was my first and last experience at Sunset. But you know it, because those are crazy waves.
They're very big waves. And Pipeline has a very big wave. Not only that, but Pipeline is famous for having a reef that's kind of a shallow reef. So if you get dumped in the wave, you're likely to do what they call a face plant on the roof and on the reef. And you could seriously injure yourself. People die. I mean, very experienced surfers die. At Waimea, for example, which has a very big wave, drownings are not uncommon. They're not uncommon, even among pretty experienced surfers. So as a subject for a book, I mean, you can see there's nothing better.
We've been speaking with Paul Theroux, novelist, it says here, travel writer. We're going to get back on that. And the author of Under the Wave at Waimea. Paul, the question I asked right before we went on the break is, for a period of about a year, for many people, maybe even 14 months for more people, nobody was traveling. You weren't traveling, but you weren't like sitting around.
No, as a matter of fact, I did travel. I spent the summer in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, where I spend most summers. And virtually every weekend, I drove up to Maine, to the Maine coast, where we have a weekend place, and spent time on the road. The traffic was a lot lighter than normal. And that was, I didn't feel confined at all. And then at the end of November, around Thanksgiving, I drove from Cape Cod to Pasadena, California, 3,000 miles. I did it in 6 days, 500 miles a day, staying in motels. That was a road trip just to see what the country looked like in the middle of a pandemic.
And what did you see? And what did you see from that? What did you learn from that?
Motels were very empty. I mean, you go in and you say, "Do you have a room?" They said, "We have, you know, 200 rooms." I brought my own food. What I learned was that there are some places that were very, very indifferent to wearing masks. I mean, places in Arkansas and Texas, Oklahoma, where they're kind of defiant. You know, we don't need a mask. We're okay. We're healthy. And other places, they were very fastidious about it. The restaurants were closed, as I say. But I found the trip amazing. First, there wasn't much traffic. There were a lot of big, you know, 18-wheelers. The trucks that go cross-country, as you know, that's a whole culture of driving. And there were plenty of trucks on the road, but very few cars. Even the day before Thanksgiving, I drove from Cape Cod to Virginia, that my first 500 miles. And although that's one of the busiest travel days of the year, it wasn't bad. It wasn't bad at all. Next day, I got to Nashville, and that was very light. That was Thanksgiving itself. I had my Thanksgiving at a rest stop. But what I found out was it's a beautiful country, and people should, you know, when this pandemic ends, or even now, I suppose you could do it, get in your car and go somewhere. You don't need to go to Istanbul. You don't need to go to Bangkok. You don't need to go to South America. This is the greatest country in the world. We have the greatest landscape, and we have the confidence that wherever you go in the United States, without exception almost, At the end of the day, you're going to find a place to stay. It might not be grand, but it'll be good. And there'll be a place to eat. And you have that comfort. You don't have to, you can wing it. You can improvise a road trip in the States and see mountains as high as most that you'd find in the world. Nice people, good food, desert. I mean, such spectacular beauty. And that's what I was continually reminded of. What a wonderful place it is that we live, that we, where you can travel. And I mean, I'm in Hawaii now. So I got to LA and I got tested for the virus and I was negative. So I flew to Hawaii, but you can drive anywhere. Anyway, I had, so that was my pandemic has never been very, very severe on me. I've been locked down as a writer. I mean, I stay home writing most of the time. And when I've traveled, I usually travel in the winter. This year, I was planning to go to Africa. I didn't go. I wasn't that sad about it. My wife and I spent more time together than ever. We had a great time. We did a lot of cooking. So it hasn't been a punishment for me. For a lot of people, it's been really, really bad. I mean, hard. They couldn't commute to work. They're working at home. So I'm not minimizing that. I'm only saying that in terms of travel, there's a lot of travel that can be done without leaving the country.
Exactly. And what we're seeing now, of course, is America, whether they like it or not, whether they planned it or not, whether they intended to do it or not, are actually at a point now where they can rediscover their own country.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think it's true. And there's some dramatic things. I mean, there are places that were new to me. I mean, I wrote a book about traveling through the South, deep South. And I thought I knew the South. Well, on this trip, I took a slightly different route through the South, and I discovered new places. I wrote a book about Mexico on the Plain of Snakes. I spent a lot of time on the border and in Texas. But this time, I went through North Texas, Amarillo. And that was all new to me, too. I mean, I was on I-40, and I stopped at Amarillo, actually, and looked around. I saw a part of Texas, and I saw there's a huge canyon in the Panhandle, almost as big as Grand Canyon. It's the second largest canyon in the United States. I had known that it existed. I looked at that. So there's a lot. Even if you have done a lot of traveling, you think you know it, there's much more to see.
You're right, and you should never take anything for granted. But I want to go back to your writing, because your approach to writing from a physical point of view is something that I do myself. You're writing a lot in longhand. You're writing on a pad of paper. You're not using a computer.
No, I don't. Well, I use a computer to do a final draft. I type, but my first draft is always written by hand. And that's the way I've done it. I mean, it worked for me when I was young, and it's a way, particularly in fiction, I need to slow down and write. And if something's unsatisfactory about it, I rewrite it. I sit down and I recopy it. People think that's laborious. Well, writing is laborious. Writing is difficult. If I had a column for a newspaper, I might sit at a computer and write the column. That's a different kind of writing. But the thought and the density that goes into fiction writing, the kind of reflection that you need, is you can't write it fast. No one can write fiction fast. I don't know anyone that ever has done that. So it's slow, it's laborious, but you get results doing it the way I do.
And fiction or not, you're writing a book against a backdrop of reality about a destination that you're learning more and more about every single day. So I guess the question is, what did you learn about Hawaii in the process of writing this book?
I learned a lot, actually. I've lived here more than 30 years, and I didn't dare to write about it for the first 10 years. Through the 1990s. I wrote a book about the Pacific, the Happy Isles of Oceania, and I wrote a little bit about Hawaii, but I didn't know it then. Hawaii is a very, very difficult place to know intimately. You think you know it, you're having a Mai Tai in Waikiki, you think you that's the essence of it. And it's a lovely experience, but there's so much more. There are subcultures here. Every part of this island that I'm on, Oahu, it has a different climate, has a microclimate, has a different ethnic identity. I mean, up the road is La'ie. It's mostly Mormons. Down the road is Waipahu, another town, mostly people of Filipino extract, out of, you know, Kahala's wealthy people, Waianae, mostly local people, I mean, of Hawaiian ancestry. So to get to know the different places, the longer you live in a place, the more you realize how complex it is, and the hardest place to write about, your listeners will understand this, is where you come from. It's your home. It's not hard to write about Bangkok. You're writing about a surface. You write about temples and gongs and flowers and people and the canals and all that. And so you go there and you think, well, you write about Bangkok. But try to write about your hometown, wherever it might be. Wellesley, Massachusetts, Dubuque, Iowa, you know, Brooklyn, wherever it might be. It's really, really hard. So I live here now, and I've lived here. So around 1998, 99, I wrote a book called Hotel Honolulu. And that was a book that is mainly about the city of Honolulu and particularly Waikiki. So Hotel Honolulu was my sort of urban book. But then I moved to the country, what they call the country here, the North Shore, which is basically a surfing culture of people located near the water. And I got to know it, and I realized it's a place all its own. It's a different culture. You pointed out earlier, a different language, a different ethic, different ways of looking at the world. And I must say, surfing is not about money. People surf for love, for pleasure, for joy. They don't. The few surfers who have endorsements are lucky. Can you hear my chickens?
I was about to ask that. Yes, we're going to talk about that in a minute.
I have chickens running wild. They nest and they lay eggs, and I have lovely omelets from them. I also have 5 very big, very noisy geese. They're nice and quiet. I fed them before I started talking to you, so they're very contentedly nibbling at pellets. But I live in the country, and they, you know, chickens are very good. They eat bugs, and the geese.
Are there any other animals we need to know about?
I don't. The other animals that you might find on my property are wild pigs, of which there are occasionally 4 or 5. Some of them very big, and that's a problem. That's a problem. But we have ways of dealing with the wild pigs. We often turn them into smoked chili, but very delicious. But lately, they've wandered away. It's been very dry, so they're somewhere else at the moment.
Well, good. They've avoided the transformation into dry chili. I got it. But
yeah.
But now you're about to travel again, I hope.
I'm looking forward to traveling. But when the pandemic began, I started to write a book, a novel, exactly a year ago, last April. I thought, well, I'm not going anywhere. I need something constructive to do. I started to write a short story. The story became much longer, and now it's a novella. A novel. I'm still working on it. So that's my activity. I mean, I work at home. I go to the beach. I sometimes work at the beach. The beaches are open here. You know, Hawaii is open for business, so plenty of people around. The hotel's about half full. Suppose you can get a good, as a travel man yourself, you can get a deal on a hotel here now.
Although I should tell you, Paul, the numbers of arrivals in Hawaii is going up by the hour. In Maui alone today, over 6,400 arrivals. So the hotel occupancies are going up. And as you've been reading in the papers in Hawaii, and as we were monitoring it from here, you can't even find a rental car in Hawaii. It's a little crazy.
Yeah, that's true. It's completely turned around. Although you need a test to come here, there are certain other restrictions because the restaurants aren't completely open. But I must say, it's a lovely place to live and to write about. But as I was saying earlier, it's very difficult to write about a place that you live in. And it's taken me 30 years actually to publish this book, or to get this book, which I think is, you know, inside Hawaii. It's the life of it's the surfing life. It's not a travel book, but it has the landscape and the people from Hawaii.
And are you still paddling? Are you still canoeing?
Yeah. I twice a week I go. There are 3 Hawaiian guys who are very good at it, and they have my back. I go out with them, 4 of us, go out in an outrigger canoe, a canoe called an OC-1. So it has an outrigger on it, what they call an ama. And we go out of Haleiwa. And sometimes catch waves. They can take bigger waves than me. It's a lovely way to spend an afternoon, you know, paddling. And I've been doing it. You know, there's an old Phoenician belief that every day you spend on the water is not deducted from your life. So I'm not real. The birthday I had is slightly bogus. I'm really not as old as I, as numbers would say, because all the day I spent so many days on the water, not deducted. So years, maybe, not deducted.
So basically, you're a Benjamin Button.
I'm probably in my 60s.
Exactly. Now, when you do travel again, you know, people are talking about a vaccine passport, proof of vaccination, as the world begins to open up. Something tells me that's going to be a requirement one way or the other. I'm assuming you've been vaccinated already?
Yes, and I may say that when I first started traveling, when I went to Africa in 1963, I had a WHO yellow vaccine, which you have, I'm sure.
I do. I still have mine, yes.
And you had to prove that you had a yellow fever shot for typhus, for diphtheria, for sleeping sickness, you know, a lot of polio, whatever it was. And it's their step that they had to be up to date. I remember I went to the Congo later in the mid-60s, and I was in Katanga, and I got off the plane, and they said, where's your health card? And I said, it's here. And they said, well, you don't have whatever jab it was. I can't remember. It might have been yellow fever. And they said, you have to go straight to the hospital and get that jab before you can circulate here in the Congo. And I think that's going to be standard in the future. Or they'll say, where's your... I have a little car that resembles it, because I've had two jabs myself, two vaccinations of Moderna. And I'm sure that will be a requirement. You get off a plane in Bangkok or wherever, Delhi, and they'll say, where's the card? Yeah, here's your passport. Where's your card? They'll examine it. They'll look at the date, and they'll say, okay, you can go. And if you don't have it, I don't know what'll happen. Maybe you'll get a jab then, or maybe they'll put you back on the plane.
Well, something tells me you'll have that figured out, and the technology will be there with sort of like a centralized set of standards to make that work. Or if worse comes to worse, you just bring the rooster.
I don't think they'd welcome my noisy rooster.
My thanks to Paul, and my thanks to Kelly Craighead, and my thanks to you for listening to this Ion Travel podcast. For more conversations with the leaders in travel, as well as answers to your travel questions, be sure to rate and review this podcast wherever you happen to listen to podcasts. And for all the breaking travel news, and as you know, that's happening multiple times every day, be sure to log on to petergreenberg.com.
Special thanks to our sponsors at Clear. Enroll in Clear at clearme.com/Peter and zip through busy airports nationwide.
If you like Ion Travel with Peter Greenberg, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Survivor 46 is here, and so is On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast, and we have a twist this season. The winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares, will be joining us every week.
We're going behind the scenes of the biggest moments, the how and the why things happen, and the strategy and analysis you can only get from someone like me, a Survivor winner.
Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planner, and host of the Money Watch podcast. This is the show where your money is not scary. It is a show that's all about you. It's your questions that make it possible for me to provide unconventional and entertaining insights on your money, and maybe more importantly, on your life. Follow Money Watch wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free on the Amazon Music or Wondery app.